Curiosity has brought you here. And though you are unsure why, you walk into the room and sit down at a small table covered in a flowing linen. There, in the middle of the table, sit a deck of cards, and across from you sits an older woman. No, you're not up for a friendly game of solitaire. This woman is a reader, and that deck of cards there in front of you is the tarot. The woman shuffles the cards and sits the deck in front of you, inviting you to give them a good shuffle as well. You awkwardly shuffle the deck in your hands, and then after a minute or so, hesitantly place them down. The woman then instructs you to cut the deck, making two stacks, which you do. She then grabs the stack on the left and begins arranging the cards on the table. After the 10th card finds its place, the woman takes a deep, calming breath and begins to flip the cards over. With every flip, a new symbolic picture is revealed, and with every picture, another detail in the story she weaves together. The story she tells with the help of these cards is a story about you, with each card revealing to the reader your past, present, and future. It's almost as if the cards are whispering to her, and she pulls together a very convincing story of what has been going on in your life and where the current path may lead. The strange thing about it is at times it's eerily on target, and at times giving you goose pimples. How can a simple deck of cards give someone so much insight into a stranger's life? How do these cards have such a reputation of accuracy? And where exactly did these cards and their strange pictures come from? How did tarot cards become such a staple for psychics and followers of the occult? Taromancy, as the prediction of the future using these cards is called, first began to gain popularity in the late 1700s. This is when the cards began to pop up in occult gatherings, used as a divination tool, whose random drawings and attached meanings were supposed to be selected by higher spirit sources. The one drawing the cards was more so the middleman, the interpreter, and would weave together the story and its meanings to the person whom the reading was done for. In order to find the inner workings and mystic history behind the tarot, let's consult the cards themselves, as who better to tell their story? Shuffle the cards well, and we'll lay out the three card spread of tarot history. Let's flip over our first card. Ah, the moon, the card of secrets, of mysteries waiting to be revealed. It begins in 9th century China, where the invention of a paper game, played similar to chess, emerged. It was small, lightweight, and was the perfect portable entertainment for long journeys. The cards were a popular item for trade as well, and soon spread over multiple continents. By the 10th century, it had made its way to Persia, then on to Egypt, and from there, by the 1400s, had found its way into northern Italy. It's from here that the game begins to change and take on some interesting forms. From this point, the most popular way the cards were played was in a fashion similar to modern-day bridge. It was a game known as Tarocchi a Property. It was a game favored amongst aristocrats, and it was a far cry from the informal, jovial version played by the rest of society. Tarocchi was considered an art, and it was essentially quite formal in nature. The players would gather around a table, and each player would be dealt a random hand of cards. The players would then look at the images on each card, and they would then compose poetic verses about one another, using the images to create thematic associations. In the late 1400s, when the cards reached France and England, the game evolved to where the players would often make up playful, predictive prose about the other people in the room. The game then became known as sorts, which meant destinies or lot in life. The images of the cards and their meanings slowly began to evolve as well. Both in France and England, during this time, there was a revival of sorts in mysticism, especially Egyptian and Hermetic. Now, because of this movement, the images began to change and take on different meanings, which represented the human journey. The images on the cards represented common archetypes, such as kings and queens, heroes and villains, hermits and fools, and priests and devils. Each card in the deck represented a certain aspect of life's struggles, and it became a deck of stories. Now, by the 1500s, a new version of the cards had appeared, a deck that was solely meant to represent the stories of the human journey. This new deck was created by a Frenchman named Marseille. Now, eventually, Marseille would become the primary source of tarot production in Europe. And throughout the next few centuries, Marseille's deck would become fully associated with mysticism. And by the 1700s, the tarot in the public's eye would become an occultic tool. Now we know the mystery behind the tarot's origin. And that is all the moon has to tell us. Now it's time to flip over another card and reveal more. Ah, the Hierophant. This card represents tradition, an institution that rises up and binds most things. By the 1800s, thanks to the rise in spiritualism, tarot underwent a bit of a renaissance. This time period could be considered tarot's golden age, as all things mystic and occult began surging in popularity. The tarot became the subject of many studies and books. There were a plethora of authors who delved deep into the subject, linking the deck and its symbolism to ancient spiritual practices, often claiming its true history was older than previously known, and that it possessed certain spiritual and magical secrets. Most of the time, the tarot was almost always attributed to ancient Egyptian mysticism, particularly to something known as the Ancient Book of Thoth. Now, many authors claimed that they were the ones who had discovered the true meaning of the cards. However, most of the time, these explanations were based on hearsay and a lot of the times just conjured up by the authors themselves. And often, they lacked any historical basis. In 1854, renowned French occultist and self-proclaimed sorcerer, Eliphas Levi, began to take a strong interest in the tarot. And it was he who saw that it could be a profound magical tool. He saw that the archetypes portrayed in the symbolism of the cards could also reflect the wide array of ideals and principles that were considered fundamental to occultists. Levi wove these principles together, along with aspects influenced by Hermeticism, Kabbalah, astrology, and alchemy. He compiled his new tarot system into his widely published work, Dogma and Ritual of High Magic. His system for the tarot was incredibly complex, and it associated each card with the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. It associated them with astrological signs and phases and even the elements. It was essentially Levi who created tarot into a tool to contemplate one's spiritual path, to gain guidance and influence on a higher level. Using this new formula of tarot, readers trained in these areas could now map out their destinies as well. Now, you may not have heard of Eliphas Levi or his published works, but you may be familiar with another one of his creations, the image of Baphomet. It was created to represent a variety of spiritual aspects and polarity. In fact, if you look up the image of Baphomet, that goat-headed, winged god, the entire illustration is incredibly symbolic. Here is what Levi said about the symbolism behind the image of Baphomet in his book, Dogma and Ritual of High Magic. The goat on the frontispiece carries the sign of the pentagram on the forehead, with one point at top, a symbol of light, his two hands forming the sign of Hermeticism. The one pointing up to the white moon of Chesed, the other pointing down to the black one of Geborah. The sign expresses the perfect harmony of mercy with justice. His one arm is female, the other male, like the ones of the androgynon of Kuranoth. The attributes of which we had to unite with those of our goat, because he is one and the same symbol. The flame of intelligence shining between his horns is the magic light of the universal balance. The image of the soul is elevated above matter as the flame, whilst being tied to matter shines above it. The beast's head expresses the horror of the sinner, whose materially acting, solely responsible part has to bear the punishment exclusively, because the soul is insensitive according to its nature and can only suffer when it materializes. The rod standing symbolizes eternal life, the body covered with scales, the water, the semicircle above it, the atmosphere, the feathers following above the volatile. Humanity is represented by the two breasts and the androgynon arms of the sphinx-like of the occult sciences. So according to the works of Levi, the image that many find to be so evil isn't so evil after all. It's more of a statement of the spiritual journey and the duality of humankind. It's the works of Levi that really set in motion for years to come the tradition of tarot. And it also brought about many spiritual institutions. The teachings of Levi are what inspired one of the most well-known magical and occultic societies of the 19th and 20th centuries, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. The Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, believed to be established in 1888, was a magical order which practiced spiritual occultism. It was influenced by a wide range of belief systems, such as ancient Egyptian, Hermeticism, Kabbalah, Christian mysticism, alchemy, Venetian magic, and a few others. It was an underground order that catered to the elite, promising them the ability to utilize magic to bend elements to their will, increasing abundance, influence, happiness, and much more. There was also a pretty hefty sign-on fee for those who wished to join, but many of the members felt it to be well worth it. Now, it appeared at the height of the spiritualism movement, so interest in such things were in vogue, and believe it or not, it had quite a healthy membership. The order centered around a series of documents that were known as the Cipher Manuscripts. It's these documents which laid out the ritual-based structure of the order. There were three main levels that members could work towards and progress to. Each level within it had multiple grades, which one needed to progress through. Each grade was supposed to relate to the positions on the Tree of Life. Grades and levels were obtained by careful study of the prescribed curriculum, a graduated set of teachings that covered Hermetic Kabbalah, astrology, geomancy, which is a form of divination that is interpreted by markings on the ground or patterns formed by tossing soil. It also covered alchemy and tarot. Studying and mastering the complicated system of tarot that Levy had constructed was a significant part of one's studies, and it was meant to take a substantial amount of time in order to be able to prove one's mastery of the skill. For many, this was the hardest part of their studies, and many would not progress past this task. And one of the people who struggled with learning this system of tarot was a man named Arthur Edward Waite. Waite, who was American-born, was a successful British author of poetry and occult studies. He dedicated a tremendous amount of his time to studying Western occultism and esoteric teachings. So it's no surprise that in 1901, he discovered and soon joined the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. For the first few years, he was an incredibly devout member, and he dutifully worked his way through the grades, and he eventually hit the portion of the studies which covered the tarot. It was at this point where Waite had his first real disagreement with the order's teachings. Waite strongly rejected what he believed were the card's unfounded connections to Egyptian mysticism, the Kabbalah, and alchemy. And being a man who had dedicated years of his life studying Western occultism, he found the lack of historical basis for many of the meanings assigned to the cards incredibly frustrating. He strongly believed that following Levy's formula and pursuing what he believed were false meanings would severely hinder one's spiritual ascension. So for Waite, this was an incredibly personal thing. So from that point on, he began to take a very keen interest in tarot. He began studying in greater detail the original Marseille decks. And he decided that this version of the tarot was the purest, and he decided to revitalize this version of the deck and create a system that relied on imagery, providing that allegorical tale of the human journey that the cards originally represented. He believed that each card and the symbology it contained, when drawn randomly, could accurately represent one spiritual and life journey, where they've been, where they are, and where they are headed. It was also during this time that Waite met a fellow order member, Pamela Coleman Smith, known to friends as Pixie. Smith, who was originally from Jamaica, was an all-around incredible person. She was an immensely gifted artist who was also quick-witted and full of vivacious spirit. She was also a costume designer, folklorist, editor, publisher, poet, and outspoken suffragist. Every project she dedicated herself to vividly embodied her creative and spiritual vision. She was really one of those unique people that come into the world. She was a unique burst of light, a wonderful splash of color in an often gray and drab world. Almost everyone who met her were instantly drawn to her. People were captivated by what the media described as the odd artist, mystic girl. Smith and Waite soon became fast friends, and they bonded over their mutual desire to understand the deeper meanings of mysticism and the occult. They had also both begun to become disenchanted with some of the teachings and operations of the order. When Waite discussed his tarot research with Smith and shared with her his vision for a modern deck and divination system, she was immediately intrigued. Waite then approached Smith with an invitation, an artistic venture that she could not refuse. Waite confided to Smith that he believed that the more pure, modern tarot he envisioned could only be brought into existence by her artistic vision. Waite would later refer to Smith as being one of the most imaginative and abnormally psychic artists to have ever lived. It was Pamela Coleman Smith who conjured the iconic visual symbology of the major and minor arcana. She was the creative vision behind modern-day tarot, and it was her deeply intuitive art that allowed the tarot to become what it is today. She was the illustrator behind the most iconic and well-known style of tarot, the one that most decks today are based off of, the Rider-Waite deck. The Rider-Waite deck is single-handedly the most popular deck even to this day, and it is the basis of modern tarot tradition in the Western world. Each picture created by Smith tells a story. It tells the story of the human journey. Every carefully thought out detail in those pictures is a piece of the story. No matter what the imagery of the deck looks like, almost all modern day tarot decks reflect the exact same symbolic elements that were conjured by the intuitive imagination of Pamela Coleman Smith. The Rider-Waite deck was also the very first version of the tarot that was used exclusively for divination. This version opened up the tarot for use by the masses. It was the democratic tarot. Now, before the Rider-Waite deck, the tarot was seen as a very solemn, magical tool. It was something that was mainly reserved for ritual. It was a way to invoke and harness different energies. It was immensely complicated, incredibly difficult to use, and it required years of study to even learn. All of the decks before the Rider-Waite deck also had very sparse imagery, pretty much like a regular deck of playing cards. There really wasn't much to be inferred through visual clues. The lack of illustrations and all those multiple meanings and spiritual associations with each card, coupled with the need for precise astrological calculations, made the tarot almost impossible for the average person to decipher and use. Because of this, it was a tool that was primarily limited for those of higher social status. For a person who was unable to make the needed calculations or was not well versed in the occult, at the very best, the cards could only be used as an allegorical means of personal reflection. However, now, with the carefully crafted illustrations coupled with a plainly written guide, which was easy for anyone to understand and follow, the tarot was now a useful tool for divination and something that could be used by anyone. Even if a person were unable to read, the card's symbolic imagery could easily be translated to any part of life's journey, giving the reader insight still into the past, present, and future. It was those intuitive images that really gave the deck its ability to act as the tool for divination that we know of today. Now that we know the institution behind some of the major tarot traditions, it's time to flip the third card and dive deeper into our journey. Ah, the Magician. This card represents the need to tap into one's full potential, to acquire the power that they need, the message to not hold back. That is just exactly how the next influencer of the tarot lived their life. By 1904, both Arthur Waite and Pamela Smith had left the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, as both had become disenchanted with the order and its teachings. The order was incredibly expensive to be a part of, and the prescribed studies often created way more questions than they answered. With this in mind, it might just seem like it was this small fly-by-night group, you know, a group that only attracted an odd few. But for a while, the numbers of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn were quite impressive, and its members were all of high society. Many of the members were quite famous for their time. In fact, the order had some of the most well-known names of that era, names that many still recognize to this day. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle of Sherlock Holmes fame, he was a member. Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, he was another prominent member, as well as mountaineer, author, and occultist Aleister Crowley. There are few figures in modern history as loathed in their time as Aleister Crowley. Crowley was quite a flamboyant and rebellious figure in a still heavily conservative society. And much of what he did was really a statement of his disdain of what he viewed as society's obsession with self-denial. Perhaps it all stems from the incredibly strict and often quite unhappy upbringing he had in a very religious household. His father was a minister and was very strict with young Crowley. One could say that he was abusive. Even as a young child, Crowley grew bitter towards the religion and its stifling rules. And as an adult, he developed a deep loathing and rejection of that belief system he was brought up in. He displayed his loathing and rejection by actively pursuing every taboo, every sin preached against. Crowley reveled in debauchery. However, he still yearned for some sense of spirituality. And he developed a keen and genuine interest in another forbidden fruit, magic and the occult. He believed that there were very real powers at play in many of the ancient teachings, powers that he wanted for his own. The thirst for this knowledge and the rewards its study would bring consumed him. It became a lifelong obsession. Crowley's interest in occultism began in his late teens, but it wasn't until he turned 21 that he was finally free to pursue it. When Crowley was 21, he gained access to his substantial trust fund, which allowed him the financial freedom to do as he pleased. He soon set off to London in search of underground societies that he had heard about that taught the magical arts. He didn't have to search long, as he was soon introduced by an acquaintance to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Given his social stature and wealth, Crowley was immediately accepted as he met all the criteria of the order's exclusive upper-class membership. Once initiated, Crowley excelled in the order as nobody else before him had. He flew through the prescribed curriculum, rapidly advancing through the grades and levels. With each accomplishment, Crowley felt a surge of power. So dedicated to the subject, Crowley firmly believed that magic was to be his vocation, and he was intent on becoming the most powerful person in the entire world in that respect. He soon began referring to himself as the Beast 666. As he advanced to the highest obtainable level and grade of the order, Crowley began to view it with bitter disappointment. It began to feel as though it were more of a social club, where all those in attendance, even those of the highest order, were simply playing with magic, as if it were just a simple means of entertainment. They became children in his eyes, and Crowley soon grew frustrated. Angered by what he viewed as a lack of dedication and reverence for the art, Crowley attempted to take the order over in attempts to align it with what he believed to be a more powerful and pure magical path. Well, not surprisingly, in this process, he clashed with many of the group's most prominent and wealthiest members, a move which proved to be his undoing when it came to the order. Soon after his failed attempt at leadership, Crowley was expelled from the order. As a testament to his self-belief, and some would say narcissism, Crowley viewed the expulsion as a form of vindication. To him, it was proof, an affirmation that he was approaching a new and far more advanced level of spiritual ascension. To him, it was a sign that he was ready to take on more powerful levels of magic. Shortly after leaving the order, Crowley set about in his magical studies and practices, attempting to use any forces he could to accomplish his will. He soon set his sights on the ultimate black magic ritual, the Abramelin. It dates back to 14th century occultism, and it was labeled as one of the most dangerous rituals one could conduct. It was said to have warned all against attempting. The Abramelin is a 6-month-long ritual that's purpose is to master demons. It was considered highly dangerous, as if it was poorly conducted or something went wrong, it was believed that the demons could and would take possession of the magician. However, those warnings only enticed Crowley, and the power that this ritual hinted at consumed him. Serious about conducting this ritual, Crowley spent months scouting out the perfect bit of land whose energy he felt resonated with his plans. After many months, he found the ideal property and purchased a bit of land for this very purpose. Land that was located in the Scottish Highlands, close to Loch Ness. On a summer's afternoon, Crowley attempted the forbidden. It was said by those who were in attendance that when he began to perform the ritual, the room of the house that he was conducting it in became pitch black, even though outside it was a bright and sunny day. Crowley's activities didn't get past the locals either, and many, who had superstitions of their own, believed that he was unleashing a horrible darkness onto the land. And many protested and did their very best to be rid of him. But as you can imagine, those actions only egged Crowley on. And he continued the ritual daily for several more months. After the 4th month, he abruptly stopped and soon left the area. An act that was totally astonishing for everyone who was assisting him. Stopping the ritual before completion was not only the greatest taboo, it was incredibly dangerous. It was believed that by doing this, it opened the magician, it opened Crowley up to possession. Which, perhaps, in some way, that may have been true. Whether or not the ill-performed ritual did as people thought, there is no denying that Crowley certainly had his demons. During his time, he was often referred to by the media as the wickedest man alive, a title he surely must have relished. Now, many people today believe that he acquired that title due to his magical and occult practices. But that's simply not the case. Crowley was wicked in other ways. He was manipulative, controlling, and abusive. When his funds ran low, he would swindle money from his followers, and he even caused the death of at least one of them for this very purpose. He was highly narcissistic and was completely consumed by that quest for power. Everyone and everything were simply pawns in his game. He was also a wanted man in several countries. And during the last few years of his life, he kind of laid low. A About 3 years before his death, Crowley rekindled an interest in the tarot. He disagreed with the Rider-Waite version, and he believed that it oversimplified tarot and it took away from the true meaning of the cards. Crowley believed that the tarot was to be used as a comprehensive magical system, that the cards could be used in order to bring about change and conformity of the will. So in 1943, he set about creating a more comprehensive and what he believed to be a more pure version of the tarot. He set about writing a comprehensive manual for the system, which he titled The Book of Thoth. Now, Thoth is the ancient Egyptian moon god, the god of knowledge, the god of wisdom and communication. In Crowley's Book of Thoth, he cleverly combined elements from the works of Eliphas Levi and of Arthur Waite. He combined the use of the deep, intuitive, illustrated symbolism of the Rider-Waite deck with the complex, deeper, associated meanings from the works of Levi. In Crowley's method of tarot, each card has layers of meaning, and each card is associated with its own divinity. In this version of the tarot, each of the cards are viewed as living beings. Each card carries a spiritual presence that can be worked with. In the Thoth deck, each card is also represented by a sephir, an angelic, and it also has its own astrological and alchemical associations. For instance, take the Five of Wands. If you pull the Five of Wands from the Thoth deck, the Five of Wands stands for strife, and it's associated with the Lord of Fire. Its sephir is Gabriel, and its astrological association is Leo and Saturn. So if we were to look at that card, all of those elements are what are supposed to contribute to the energies and provide you the clues on how to invoke those energies and use them for your will. In this deck, the card shows you that there are forces and actions that need contained, allowing you to take control. So the idea was that you would take these energies, make them work with you, and contain the energy or event that needed to be moved to your will. For the most part, the Thoth deck is an incredibly difficult system. It's very hard to interpret, and it often really feels quite incomprehensible. His main idea behind the cards is that it gives you an idea of what's going on and shows you what energies you need to work with to avoid or to make a situation come to pass. Its intent was to tie into his practices of ceremonial magic so that the practitioner would work with the magical energies that aligned with the astrological elements and invoke the entities associated with them. In the Book of Thoth, Crowley stresses that each card is a living being, that within each card, there are different energies at play, some of which completely contradict one another and don't seem to mingle well. Crowley believed a large part of mastering the tarot was being able to create a diplomacy between these conflicting energies, allowing a means for these energies to come together, creating a balance. And once the balance is achieved, you could then use these energies to bring about your will. So really, it was a magical tool for manifestation. What's interesting is even the back of the cards of the Thoth deck were meant to aid in the harnessing of those energies. The back of the cards were meant to act as a scrying symbol, and the illustration itself was meant to be deeply symbolic. The rose cross, or sometimes called rosy cross, on the back serves the purpose of unifying the cards in the magical system. It represents the mingling of beliefs that the system was founded on. It represents the Egyptian Ankh, the Christian symbol of resurrection, elements related to Kabbalah, and even alchemy. The cross itself is divided into five different colored sections: red, blue, yellow, black, and white. These colors correspond to the elements: red for fire, blue for water, yellow for air, black for earth, and white for spirit. The rose in the middle of the cross has 22 petals. The 22 petals correspond with the number of letters in the Hebrew alphabet. All of these elements are supposed to be meditated on before flipping the cards and revealing the energies at hand. Now, many in the tarot community shy away from the Thoth method, as again, it's incredibly complicated. It's a system that, when you use it the way it's supposed to be used, is incredibly difficult to decipher. It requires a deeper background knowledge. And even then, it is not as basic as relying on images, and especially not as basic as relying on images to tell a person's fortune. It's something that's ritualistic. The Thoth deck is the absolute most difficult deck to understand, but it is also supposed to be the most comprehensive tool when it comes to manifesting one's will. What do you think about the tarot? Do you prefer the Rider-Waite system, the system that just relied on intuitive images to help you find your path to tell the fortune? Or do you prefer the complex Thoth method, the one that relies more as a way to manifest and bring about things based on the energies associated? The history of the tarot may not run as deep as many want to believe, but its history is still an incredibly interesting one. And it's the starting point for so many other aspects of what is considered occult. The thing I found interesting when researching the tarot is just how much it ties in with the origins of so much of modern Western occultism and even witchcraft. If you're a follower of Wicca, it essentially has the same roots of tarot, coming from the ideas and writings of Eliphas Levi. And Levi's works inspired a wide range of beliefs, from Wicca to even forming the basic groundwork for Anton LaVey's version of Satanism. So most of what we have today when it comes to really anything occult or anything magic, you can trace it back, and it all seems to circle back to 1854. And it all seems to circle back to a certain book, The Dogma and Ritual of High Magic. Seems that everything we have today in that sense all seems to somehow make its way back, somehow or another, to Eliphas Levi. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and I hope you enjoyed this little tarot reading. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out our website, nighttideradio.com. That's N-I-G-H-T-T-I-D-E radio.com. You can also find us on iTunes or Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and many more resources. So thank you again for listening. And with that, I'm Stacy, and this is Nighttide.